A lot of people aren't sleeping enough. They're working hard, they're trying to stay positive, and they still completely feel drained, even if they get enough of sleep. So the question is, what if you're not tired because you're weak? What if your brain is carrying unfinished emotional weight that you don't even realize is there? Today, we're talking about something so many people feel but cannot always explain. My guest today is Larry Freeney. Larry has delivered over 7,500 clinical sessions across mental health and financial counseling and personal development, and the creator of powerful frameworks that help people understand why they feel stuck and how to reclaim their energy, identity, and purpose. Now, today we're breaking it down why so many smart, driven people are feeling exhausted and how to start getting your mind, your energy, and your life back. Larry, welcome to the show. I'm really excited to have you here.
Thank you so much, Stacey.
Now, let's start here. Like, you've worked with thousands of people who look successful on the outside but feel stuck on the inside. Why is that so common today?
I think it's honestly because many people have adopted values that are not their own and they're living by them. So, for instance, we live in a very, especially if you're a man, a very profession-driven world. So if you go to a party, if you go to a gala and you meet a guy, the first thing they're going to ask is, what do you do? What is your profession? That's kind of your identity. I think because that is, when I did my dissertation, I did it on the lived experience of millennials with student loan debt. And one of the lenses I used was what's called the cultural life script. And the cultural life script basically says there's a set of spoken and unspoken rules that we are called to live our life by. We're supposed to go to a good high school, get good grades, so we get into the good college, so we get this good job, so we can get the house, the 2.5 kids, and the white picket fence and get married, right? That's the American dream. What happens is many people, especially in my, as I've been counseling, they're living their parents' dreams. They're living dreams like their parents want them to be a doctor or engineer. So they go and be a doctor, an engineer, and they can be quite successful at it. They can have the skills. They put in the time, the effort. They can get the skills necessary, but they're not fulfilled. This unfulfillment comes from the lack of alignment. So I want you to think of cell differentiation. So we have trillions of cells in our body, and each cell has the entire human genome within it. It has the code for it.
Yeah.
But each cell is only called to run one program. So a heart cell runs the heart program, the neuron runs the neuron program, and so forth. So we as human beings, we have the totality of human potentiality within us.
Right.
But we're only called to run one program.
Right.
And the biggest thing that I see is people are so drained, they're so tired, they're so exhausted because they're running a program they were never meant to run.
Exactly. That makes so much sense. Now, what are people carrying internally that they don't realize is draining them?
So there's a lot. I actually coined a term. It's called the Hydra of Half Living. So my whole philosophy is on this. It's called being fully alive. And it's called closing the gap between who we are in actuality and who we could be in potentiality.
Right.
So there's a new book that just came out by MJ DeMarco, and it's called Choose Hard, Live Easy. It's called The Paradox of Hard and Easy. So if you want an easy life, do hard things.
Right.
If you want a very hard life, do easy things. So I created this concept called the Hydra of Half Living, and it stops you from closing that gap between who you are and who you could be.
Right.
So the seven heads are something that we have to battle, and each person has a different relationship with each of the heads, and sometimes they work together. So the first one is called the Phantom, and the Phantom is the head of self-delusion. So it's the head that tells you you can have the life that you dream about, that you fantasize about, that you truly feel called towards without putting in the work.
Right.
Here and think about it all day, and one day it'll magically happen. So that's a big head that gets a lot of people. The second one that comes in is the Whisper. And the Whisper is going to be kind of the self-esteem kind of piece. So anytime you try to break out of the mold of what your family wants or what culture tells you, it's that voice that says, are you sure you're going to be the one to do that? No one in your family has gone to college, or no one in your family has started a business, or no one in your family has written a book. Who are you to do that?
Right.
Then the next one is going to be what I call the sentence. And so the sentence is, so the judge isn't present, but the sentence has already been passed. And this is self-contempt. It's hard for us to be successful when we are sabotaging ourselves, when we actively dislike or even hate ourselves. This is where we have shame, we have guilt, we have this whole plethora of negative emotions. And one of my favorite that I suffer with from time to time is the saboteur. So the saboteur is, there's this psychological framework where we are only happy in a certain realm of life. So if we're up here, things are going great, we're happy. If things are down here, they're not as great, but we can still function. Anytime something goes outside of that range, our amygdala activates and we perceive it as an active threat. So that's why if something great happens to you, so say you've had a bunch of terrible relationships and you finally found that one person who treats you with dignity and respect, gives you the time that you need and supports you in everything you do, your brain will perceive that person as a threat.
Right.
And so then we'll self-sabotage the relationship so we get back to that level of dysfunction that feels safe.
I like that.
Yeah. So we have a few more heads. Another one that comes to mind is what I call the fortress. And the fortress is the tendency, and I do this sometimes. So I love connection. I love people. That's why I have a bunch of kids, because I don't want privacy and I want someone on me 100% of the time. Right?
Yes.
I'm kidding. I don't want that, but that's my life. That's my life. But the fortress is where you isolate yourself from others. So there's a difference. So they're saying that isolation is the poverty of self, but solitude is the richness of self. So stability, solitude is the ability to be alone and not lonely. Isolation cuts you off from your support group, cuts you off from those positive influences in your life. And that's when the other head, such as the whisper or the sentence, can kind of dig deep and do more damage. Now, we also have the siege. You know, as an endurance athlete, it's always important to take care of your physical animal. So eating well, taking those naps, exercising, getting enough sleep, all these aspects go into how you feel. So it's a misnomer. We call it mental health, but I don't like to call it mental health, because if you're mentally sick, the rest of you is going to be sick too, because you're one organism. If you're drained, you're physically drained, you don't feel like being emotionally available for your kids, for your spouse, for those around you.
Yeah.
So all these heads, they kind of work in tandem. And, you know, the last one is going to be the mask. And this is the one that I think many people are living, especially in the social media age. The mask says everything is fine. Everything is great. There's no issues. We don't have problems. And sometimes we say that enough. We put that mask up for so long that we forget it's not our real face.
Yeah.
So this is why, you know, we're doing all the right things at work. We're doing all the right things on the outside. But our relationship with our spouses, with our kids, with our friends, and even ourselves is superficial. It's hollow. The brain is afraid to go on that odyssey, that internal journey, to get to know ourselves, to discover our core four values, and to find out what we were truly made for.
I love that. I love that. Now, you talk about something called cognitive fragmentation. Like, why can someone sleep 8 hours and still wake up exhausted?
So this is this thing called the Guynard effect, which is basically this. It is that every time you don't have a endpoint or a solution for a thought or an idea, it runs an open loop in your brain. So anytime you think of, what am I going to have for dinner? And so even though you're going to a meeting, that thought is still loading in your head. What are you having for dinner? And then say someone texts you. Now there's this thing called cognitive fragmentation. So every time you are doing a task and you get a text message and you look at that text message, it'll take you 23 minutes to get your full attention back on that task if you have no other interruptions. Now, how many times do we only get one text message? We get a text message, we get an email, someone knocks on the door. So these are all these fragments that are open loops that are now draining powerful cognitive energy away from us.
Right.
So now we can't focus because our attention is literally scattered. And the way that reels are nowadays, you know, the YouTube shorts, these videos, our focus isn't being reinforced. We're being reinforced. We're getting that dopamine hit of those quick videos. And when we do that, our brain is like, why do I want to spend all this time building up something to hopefully get this dopamine effect when I can just get that quick, easy dopamine hit? And that's
right.
Why we're becoming, you know, the technological zombies.
Yeah.
Have you ever left your house, Stacey, and forgotten your phone and you're like, no, right? It feels like a part of you is missing. Or if you've already got to your destination, you realize you forgot your phone and you're worried, oh no, someone's going to be texting me, someone's going to need me. And
yeah.
We come back home and literally no one has messaged us. It's so eye-opening, but that's what's happening. We're becoming so dependent on this technology. It's a great tool. It's a great tool if you can master it. But what if it masters you? It resets your physiology, because our brain was never meant for this level of technology this quickly.
Yeah.
So our brain evolves over time very slowly. The technology gets faster and faster and faster. When I grew up, we didn't even have social media at the very beginning. We barely had the internet, right? We had the dial-up where you had to wait for it to connect.
Yeah.
Now we're always on. We're always connected. And our brains are taking the toll.
I love that. Now, why are these open loops, people? Carrying?
They're carrying a lot of things. So if we go back to the hydra of half living, so some of them, it ruminates and it compounds. So it's, oh, I need to figure out what we're having for dinner tonight. And if I don't figure out what we're having to dinner, right, we just go on and on and on and on. And so that feeds into the whisper. See, you can't even figure out what we're having for dinner tonight. And that feeds onto something else into something else. So what I think here is we're letting our brain be get hijacked by our amygdala. Remember, our amygdala is the part of the brain that wants to keep us alive. That's its whole goal. It doesn't care if we're happy. It doesn't care if we're thriving. It just wants us alive. So it's like the fire alarm. And the fire alarm is great when there's a fire, but it's terrible when nothing is happening.
Right.
So what we can do is in that moment, that's why emotional language is so important. There's a book by Brené Brown, Atlas of the Heart, and it goes over the 87 different emotions of the human experience. And it's so important because when you can name what you're experiencing, your prefrontal cortex, the part of your brain that's necessary for empathy, for meaning making, for deep connection, that comes online and it helps you to resolve the emotional issues of the amygdala.
Yeah.
So people are carrying so many unseen battles. And remember, with the mask, everyone looks what? Fine.
Right. That's so true. Now, how do unresolved relationships like grief, old identities, or unfinished emotional experiences drain the mental energy?
Yeah. So those would be like the biggest pulls, I think, because so I have to say we're time travelers.
Yeah.
And so it's always good to visit the past and to visit the present. But I say they're a terrible place to live. Life happens in what MJ DeMarco calls momentality. And so that's basically 10 seconds. So your life is made up of several 10-second intervals, and those are what build your life. So for the last 5 years, those 10-second intervals has made your life today. If you're happy with your life, congratulations, high five your past self, because that's the reason you're enjoying your life.
Yeah.
Now, if you're not quite happy with your life right now, then it's up to you to set up future you for success.
Right.
And so what we have to do is we have to find meaning and purpose in these relationships. So Vishen Lakhiani, in his book, The Code of the Extraordinary Mind, which is kind of a hint where I got my book title from, because it was pivotal from that,
right,
is that he talks about we have to think of success as how did we grow? So he says, so unfortunately, you lost your marriage, his marriage of 20 years. What did you learn about yourself and how did you grow?
Right.
So you get fired from a job. What did you learn? How will you grow? Say you started that company, you took the risk and you burned it to the ground.
Right.
It sucks, yes. But what did you learn and how did you grow? So instead of thinking those small windows of success, we have to think of everything has the capacity for success, for us to grow, to learn more about ourselves, and to then utilize that in the next attempt, in the next phase of our lives. So many people are going to be stuck in the past, right? They're not able to live in the present because the past has its hooks within us. So we have to go through that process and kind of, I don't know if you remember Marie Kondo, right? And the getting rid of all the stuff, decluttering your home.
Yeah.
We have to do that with some relationships, with old identities.
Mm-hmm.
I like to call it cognitive fragmentation or soul fragmentation. So if you're familiar with the Harry Potter series, we look at Voldemort, he took his soul and he split it into many different parts.
Right.
So he wasn't able to love and be integrated. And we do the same thing. We take a part of ourselves and we put it in our work identity. We put it in our profession. We put it in the house that we live in, the car that we drive.
Yeah.
All these things. So they're outside of ourselves so that we can, you know, live on this plane that's further than where we are within ourselves.
Yeah.
So that we can hope to live on in these things that we owned. And everybody wants their name on a hospital, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we can have this legacy. But the legacy is really and how we touch people and how we leave what I call the indelible mark or the soul prints on them and in their lives.
I love that. Now, if you're listening and this already sounds like you, make sure to follow this podcast because these are the conversations that help you understand what's really going on underneath the stress, the burnout, and the overwhelm. You use the term auretic gap. Can you explain what that means in a simple term?
Yeah. So simply, this is what I was speaking on earlier. It's simply the gap between who you are and who you could be. So think of it. The auretic gap is the version of you who maybe, you know, life has been a little bit hard, so you stop going to the gym, you know, you find yourself sitting on the couch, scrolling through Netflix, on your phone, eating some snacks. So we know the version of you, who you could be if you worked out every day consistently, if you took better care of your health, if you slept more, if you had more positive relationships.
Yes.
So that gap is simply, and the best part is the gap is asymptotic. So if you remember high school math, that means that you can get closer to it, but you'll never fully close that gap.
Yeah.
So that's a blessing and a curse. It means that there's always more to do and there's always more to do.
Yeah.
So there's this form of you that will never come to fruition, to realization, but you can get closer to that through every decision that you make. So when your alarm goes off at 5 o'clock in the morning because you're going to get up and go run, if it goes off and you get up, boom, that's one vote for your auretic self for you to close the gap. If you snooze it a few times, what are you? You're widening that gap. You're
right.
causing that version of you, what I call the erratic self, to get right. further and further away. And so that's the purpose of life, is to close the erratic gap in our lives so we can be the best possible version of ourselves, so we can be more effective with people and efficient with our tasks.
I love that. Now, is this gap between who we are right now and who we know we could become?
Yes. And so what I like to think of, well, think of yourself 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So if I think about myself 5 years ago, I had one kid. Yes, I had one daughter, and I think we're pregnant with the second.
Okay.
And so we didn't have our house yet. We were building our house. My wife didn't have her law firm yet. I didn't have my doctorate yet. I had more hair. All right. So it was a completely different life. But our lives, if you think about it, that's the growth gap. But that's the gap that I was closing now. And a lot of times we don't reverse engineer that gap. This is something that happened. Now we can see how different our life is. Just think how different our life will be in 5 years. As John Zafori, he calls this a 5-year crusade.
Right.
How do you want to change in the next 5 years? Myself, I like to say, since I'm 34, I am Larry version 3.4.
Yeah.
And in September, I will be upgraded to Larry version 3.5. Now, what upgrades do I want this version of me to have? And the only way they can have upgrades is by what? Choosing hard things. So I'm doing an ultra race coming up, the Spartan Ultra in October.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing this book. We just had our fifth kid. So I'm doing a lot of things that are what forcing me to become a better version of myself, a more capable version of myself. So many times people are like, Larry, how do you do everything you do and don't burn out? It's because I keep doing hard things. So when life throws hard things at me, it's just another day in my life. It's
right.
not something that throws me off course. David Goggins also talks about this in his book, Never Finish. So his second book, he calls them mental zones. He says that most people's minds are like the average American garage, messy, right? You can't fit anything in there.
Right.
But what happens when you take the day, maybe the weekend, and you get containers and you put everything where it's supposed to go? You find out that there's so much more room in that garage. And guess what? You might be able to actually fit a vehicle in there. It's the same thing, Stacey, with our minds. Right now, if things aren't in the right place, that's when we have those open loops. We have all this clutter that's not important, this clutter that we don't even have to worry about.
Right.
But what happens, the way our brain works, is it is perceived by a threat in our brain. So that means we have what? We have the adrenaline kickoff, we have the cortisol rate, and we can't rest when our sympathetic nervous system is activated. It's physically
right.
important. We can't rest, we can't meditate, we can't calm down. So to stop this hijack, we have to stop and put things where it belongs. So here's a way that you can close some of those gaps, is you have to give each one of these things an endpoint. It doesn't have to be a permanent endpoint.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, you say, I need to figure out what we're eating for dinner tonight.
Right.
Well, I'll worry about that at 3. So I'll set a reminder for 3:00. I'm going to figure out what we're eating for dinner. Great. Now my brain can close that loop. It doesn't have to worry about it anymore. Now, maybe you're in a relationship that you know is not benefiting you and you should probably end, but you're afraid to, right? We have the sunken cost fallacy. I put all this time, this energy into it. Or maybe even you fought your parents or your friends. They said, this person's not for you, and you double down.
Right.
You don't want to look like the fool. So that is going to be pulling energy from you besides the relationship, but your decision to want it. So what you can say is, I will think about this on the weekend, or Saturday at 5:00 is the time that I'm dedicating to this part.
Right.
Great. Now your brain's like, cool. Now you don't have to worry about it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So you're offshooting, you're offloading, you're putting things in its proper place so that when life throws those level 5 emergencies at you, you're able to say, hey, I have thought about this. I know what to do. I'm not caught off guard.
Right. I love it. Now, why do people feel that version of themselves is possible, but still cannot seem to get there?
Yeah. So I like to think of this as a seed. So the word, what I call the erratic gap, comes from the word arete, which it comes from Aristotle. And so arete basically means human flourishing. So it's not getting by, it's not surviving, it's not just making it to the weekend. It's literally flourishing in your life. Excited when you get up in the morning, going out and doing something that puts you, that sets you on fire.
Yeah.
So that's where that comes from. And there's this force within us called entelechy. And entelechy is the force towards perfection. So it's the force that causes the acorn to become the oak tree, and it causes the kitten to become the cat.
Right.
Now, what's good about the kitten and the acorn is that they don't have to do anything. You basically live, survive, and you will become what you're supposed to. Now, us, as part of the human condition, we actually have to put our will into it. We have to do something about it.
Right.
So I always feel this force to get this book out. I feel this force to go and teach and to speak. And many times, what we're not doing is we're not putting ourselves out there and we're waiting for the universe to send it to us.
Yeah.
So we're like, oh, we'll want this spouse who's going to do this, be and understand me and just be a great fit. But we're not going to look for them.
Right.
We're just They'll find me. We're hoping the phone rings. And here, what I like to say is we don't want to chase these individuals. We want to become the type of person that attracts them. Exactly. We don't want to be fishing for them. We want to be magnets.
Right.
So Stacey, if you ever tried to chase a cat or a rabbit, you know that that cat or that rabbit will not be caught if it doesn't want to be caught.
Exactly.
But if you bring some food out and that cat's hungry, that cat will come to you. And it's the same thing for the things that we want in our life.
Yeah.
If you chase that job, you chase that person, you chase the book, whatever it is, it's going to run away from you. But if you attract it, if you get down and figure out what are your core four values, if you figure out who you are, if you figure out the seed that you are, if you're an apple seed, you can only turn into an apple tree. If
right.
you're an orange seed, you can only turn into an orange tree.
Right.
So many of us are apple seeds, but we want to be something else.
Right.
And that's when we're in misalignment. That's where our brain has those open loops. That's when we're draining our energy because it doesn't flow from us. Because why?
Yeah.
We're misaligned.
Exactly. Now, you created a framework around this emotional vocabulary. Why does it matter the most when people only have a few words for what they feel?
So think of the words that we have. Words allow us to see things. They've done studies on this before.
Right.
They did this one study. I forget the individual involved, but basically they had 7 sheets of paper and one of them was slightly off color. So it was all the shades, same shades of green, and one was blue.
Okay.
And so they asked the Americans, you know, hey, which one is different? And of course they point to the blue ones.
Yeah.
Now they asked this indigenous tribe which one was different and they couldn't see it because in their language, they had no word for the color blue.
Right.
But they then gave them one where all of them were the same shade of green, except one was a little off.
Yeah.
None of the Americans, because we say green, right, could really tell the difference, but they were able to point to it easily because their language described it.
Right.
So our language allows us to experience and explore worlds that don't exist anywhere else. Most of what we value today only exists because of language.
Yeah.
So we look at my state, Texas. Texas in itself doesn't actually exist. It's a plot of land. But the idea, the concept of Texas is what?
Yeah.
It exists because of language, written and verbal language. So social media doesn't exist. It only exists because it's written and language, right? So language gives us the ability to understand what we see around us. Now, the internal landscape, if we have 87 plus emotions, and we can't describe them, what happens is what I call a double disconnect.
Yeah.
So the first disconnect is between you and your own body. So you become disembodied.
Yeah.
And then we have a tendency to intellectualize everything because intellect is safe, emotions are not.
Yeah.
So think of the 5-year-old who's afraid of the dark. They're not actually afraid of the dark. They're afraid of the unknown. So for us, we become afraid of our emotions because we don't know what it is. It's just an overwhelming sense.
Yeah.
So here I use what's called the prism.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at light, the light around us, it's white light. And we can't see all the different spectrums. But if you take a prism and you shine that white light through it, you can see the entire spectrum.
Right.
And that's the same thing through our emotions. That's why we need to know the difference between frustration and anger, or the difference between guilt and shame, or jealousy. Here's a big one, jealousy and envy. Now, in society, we use it incorrectly all the time. We use them interchangeably, and they're not. Jealousy is the fear of losing a relationship or part of a relationship to another person. And envy is wanting what another one has.
Right.
So as you can see, I'm a beautiful bald man. I would love your hair, Stacey. I would love to have some luscious hair of my own. That would be envy and not jealousy. But when we have this language, we're able to process and understand what's happening to us more.
Yeah.
Then we are able to share this with our loved ones. So
right.
with many men that I've counseled, they can't share what's happening to their spouse, not because they don't want to, because they don't know how. No one ever sat down and taught them, hey, this tightness in your chest, right? That's coming from this emotion. And each of the emotions, funny enough, has an address within our body.
Right.
So whenever we're stressed or overwhelmed, what? We feel it in our shoulders because we're carrying the weight of the world on our shoulders. When we're afraid, we feel it in our stomach, in our gut. And so these are just some of the things that when we have the language for it, we can describe it, but we can also alleviate it. Remember,
yeah.
when we have the words to describe it, the prefrontal cortex comes online and it helps to dilute the overwhelming sensation of the emotions.
Right. So well said and so true. And I don't think people realize that all the time. I think people like you and I, you know, realize that, you know, when we have certain emotions and we don't even know what's going on, but we will feel them. We will feel the pressure on our shoulders, or we will have our back will start to hurt us in certain areas. Or we'll, like you said, we'll have the pressure in the chest, or our stomach won't feel right, you know. Now, these are all emotions to a root cause of something, you know, but if we took time out and really think about, you know, why am I feeling this way? You know, and really, you know, go back and really be honest with ourselves, or have somebody like yourself to talk about it, maybe from an unbiased outside point of view. We can find that root cause and we can heal that and then help us so we can move forward in a more happier, more productive and lighter way, if you know what I mean. You know, when feel that sense of lightness, you're lifting up all that baggage and you're letting it fly away. You know, something that's not always easy for many, but if you learn how to do it, it could be just exhilarating, you know, feeling for a human being.
I have to think of it like a massage for your soul, because your body holds on to emotions.
Yeah.
There's a whole book on it, the body keeps the score.
Yeah.
It's so true. And so when you have the language for it and you're able to sit and process it, it's basically like you're working out those places. So you're able to function more. You're able to have that alignment more, and you're able to go out and, as I say, light the flame of others.
Yeah. I love that. Now, what happens when every emotion gets reduced to I'm fine, or I'm stressed, or how can naming what we feel help us heal or move us like forward?
So I'm fine is the color of the head of the Hydra we talked about earlier, the mask.
Yeah.
So the mask says I'm fine. Everything is great. Don't worry about me. One thing I want to share is that I lost my brother in 2020 to suicide. And
that's so
kind
sorry.
Of he was fighting a battle that no one knew about, because he had mastered, I'm fine, everything is good, right? He had the business he was working on. He had the family. He had all the things, the external success. But he was fighting this battle that ultimately he lost and cost him his life.
Yeah.
And so whenever you're able to name it, whenever you're able to understand what's happening, now it doesn't go away in one day. And the Hydra is something, just like Hercules, we're going to have to face throughout our lives.
Yeah.
They say that our ego, we have to face our ego at three points in our lives: when we aspire for something, when we fail, and when we succeed. So it's always going to be there. And it's how we see it as in each of the heads. And I talk more about this in my one-on-one coaching process, but each of the heads is hiding a secret superpower.
Yeah.
So for instance, remember the head, what I call the phantom, is self-delusion.
Yeah.
So that head is hiding vision. So vision to see and to plan and to reverse engineer where you feel like you're called to be. The mask is really good. It's hiding the power of connection.
Right.
Because it allows you, once you understand your own emotions, you're able to pick them up in others. Now, you're not able to say, hey, this person is feeling this, but you're more receptive. Stacey, have you heard of the mirror neurons? I'm pretty sure you have.
Mirror neurons.
Yeah. All right. Well, here's something great. So this is why I love neuroscience. So mirror neurons are the neurons within your brain that fire when you're watching someone else do something.
Okay.
So if you're watching, if you've been a dancer your life and you're watching other dancers, the mirror neurons in your head will fire as if you're the one doing it.
Okay.
So what's interesting is this is a physiological basis for empathy. So when you see someone who has the canon features of someone who is sad, right? The frown, the kind of like withdrawn body, those neurons will fire in your brain. So you can feel that in the moment a little bit. So then you're able to better relate to that individual that you see. So we see that empathy is not just this emotional state. It is, but it's also physiological and neurological as well. So that's why it's important that when you're, especially when I'm working with clients, those who don't know how to regulate, self-regulate yet, I help them co-regulate. So they regulate off of me and my neurons and my calmness. And that teaches their nervous system how to calm down as well.
Oh, I love that. I've taken a lot of psychology classes, but I have not heard of the mirror neurons. But I'm glad today that I learned about them.
You got to get into the neuroscience side. That's where the real fun is.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually took a class on neuroscience and I was in my glory because the teacher actually, I was sitting in the front row. He picked up my leg and he was using me as a neuron to explain to the class what a neuron was. Had the most beautiful blue eyes that you ever saw. I said, oh my God, he used me as a neuron. He used me as a neuron.
I love that.
Now, I have another question for you. Now, you have this powerful idea called Hydra of Half Living. What does that actually mean?
What that actually means in 2025, so there's this idea, I call them forced transformation events.
Mm-hmm.
They're events that you can either engineer or life will throw at you. I prefer to engineer. Where you basically have no hope for success. The goal is to force you to become a more capable version of yourself. In 2025, I did what is known as the Spartan Winter Death Race, which is... it's home at a Pittsfield, Vermont at Riverside Farm. We gathered there. The low was -2. The high was 18 degrees Fahrenheit. And The thing is, you can't prepare for it. You have no idea what you're doing. So we were responsible for all of our food, all of our gear, everything. We had medics, and the medics' job, they only had one job, and that was to keep us alive. That was it. So this is me from being born and raised in Texas. I don't know anything about cold. I don't know anything about elevation.
Right. Yeah.
And I found out, Stacey, you probably know this, but winter gear is expensive.
Very expensive.
I was looking at some pants, and they were $1,700. I was like, no, thank you. So I decided I was going to do the death race on a budget. So there was 19 of us who were crazy enough to do this. The first thing, we got checked out by the medics. And the first thing, we did a bunch of things. But the first thing, for it to really count as a death race, they froze our bibs. And each one of us had our own number. They froze our bibs in the middle of a frozen lake. Remember, it's about 5 degrees right now at this time. They give us our axes, and we have to cut our way to the middle of the lake, find our bib, and put it on. That's the official start of the death race. Now, I was in the water for over 30 minutes because someone had freed my bib and it had floated away. And so I could not find my bib. And so they made me get out because they're like, hey, you're going to get hypothermia, or you're going to get frostbite, which we had to sign a waiver that says in big letters, I may die. So we have to sign that.
My God.
And my wife, being the attorney she is, says, don't be negligent. So here I am being negligent and finally get to this whole process. But the Hydra of Half Living, you have to do these forced transformation events. These things are going to push you so far outside of your comfort zone.
Yeah.
Because comfort is the enemy of the unreasonable life. Comfort is what causes us to become soft, what causes us our skills, our abilities, ourselves to atrophy.
Yeah.
So I like to say, when we're born, everything is chaos. Nothing makes sense to us.
Right.
Over time, we begin making a little bit of order. Like, oh, I see this face. They feed me. Oh, this must be mom, or this must be someone who cares about me. So I get happy when I see this person because I know my belly is going to be full.
Right.
And as we're younger, like watching my one-year-old son right now, he is chaos incarnate. He's just into everything. Mm-hmm. But that's what he's called to do. When we get to a certain age, we stop embracing the chaos. We stop going out there and we stay in our little comfortable zone. So the Hydra of Half Living feeds off of that. So for me, the Hydra of Half Living is that version of us that wants to keep us small. That's the enemy that stops us from living our best life.
Right.
That's the part of us that will stop us, me, from writing that book I'm called to write, or stop that individual from becoming the doctor who's going to save countless lives.
Right.
It's kind of the shadow parts of ourselves that we have to overcome.
Yeah.
So that we can then light up the world. And so doing the death race, even though it was terrible, I got frostbite. I got hypothermia. One of the racers actually had to have her big toe surgically removed due to stage 3 frostbite. Right. But when you strip away all the comfort and you're on this mountain after doing 1,500 jumping jacks, 300 something burpees and whatever, and not being able to feel your feet for 12, 19 hours. There was this moment, which the Romans call the genius and the ancient Greeks called the daemon. It's like the best version of ourselves.
Right.
The version of us that's not overshadowed or complicated by conditions of worth or the expectations of others.
Yeah.
I felt this sense of I heard this voice. It came from within. Is it enough? I didn't know if I was hallucinating, Stacey, because like I said, it was cold.
Yeah.
I was tired.
Right.
I hadn't eaten in a while because all my food froze.
Right.
But in that moment, I felt the sense of I had gotten what I needed to out of this forced transformation event.
Right.
I had this change of self, this change of essence.
Yeah.
And so then I was able to go back home, be more affectionate and connective with my wife, with my kids, and going out there and choosing things for myself, right? Not waiting for life to happen to me, but for me to get out of bed and me happen to life.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons our interview, our conversation is happening today.
Yeah.
Because I saw it. I was like, you know what? Let's reach out. Let us create the pathways for others to find us,
exactly.
For find me, and for me to go out there, because I feel like I have a mission, is to help people to close that erratic gap, not to live in complacency, not to live in conformity, but to go out there and to shine brightly. As I'm taking this from Vishen Lakhiani, he says, we're called to radiate, not imitate. But I took it and I said, we're called to illuminate. Not imitate.
I like that. I like that a lot. Now, why do patterns like perfectionism, people-pleasing, self-doubt, procrastinating, and self-sabotage keep coming back?
It's basically fear. So two things are going to stop you from closing the erratic gap. Fear and laziness. Fear of, if I become myself or if I am my full self, others will turn away. Others will not like me.
Yeah.
So what happens is we become a slave when we're people pleasers because we're afraid that the real version of us, people won't like that version of us.
Right.
And so what happens is our self-worth and our ability to feel like we're able to be loved comes from what we do, not who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very dangerous piece because you can never win. It's basically, I've heard this analogy, it's basically you're trying out for a part in a play that you'll never get.
Yeah.
So you're showing up and you're doing these aspects. And they show up because there's that fear of what happens when I step out of it. Remember, the amygdala doesn't like a threat on us. And every time you step out, every time you do something for you, well, I hear this all the time from my clients. Oh, if I do this for myself, I'll be selfish.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa. This isn't selfish. This has a self-interest, which is good, but it's not selfish. And so what happens is we create this system where anything that is good for us or anything that we do for ourselves is considered selfish, which is then inherently bad. So then we never take care of ourselves. We don't have self-care. And self-care is not that, it's a buzzword nowadays. It's like, oh, a spa day. No, self-care is taking ultradian rhythm breaks, those breaks in between meetings. It's hydrating, it's sleeping enough, it's exercising, it's having relationships, it's being a part of something greater than yourself, and is you taking whatever that masterpiece that is within you and sharing it with the world. Now, this is self-care. And so I think these things stick around because we don't hit the root of the problem. What do? We explain it away. We don't want to deal with it right now. So instead of taking the time to figure out who I am, what I love, and what I want to do in my life, it's easier for me just to become what you want me to become because it's less vulnerable.
Exactly. And why does willpower often make those patterns worse?
I don't know if you know this, but willpower is actually a finite resource. Willpower, they did a study on getting parole. They did a study with judges. And so they had judges in the very beginning of the morning, right at 8 o'clock, the judge was more likely to give your client parole. As you got closer to lunch, that from an 80% chance dropped down to about a 0% chance.
Really?
Then after lunch, it went back up. And then as it got towards the end of the day, willpower was gone. So therefore, it was basically zero. This is why decision fatigue is so real. This is why Steve Jobs had the same outfit every day. He knew the value of willpower and he didn't want to waste it deciding what I'm going to eat today and what I'm going to wear today.
Right.
Instead, he already set that up. So willpower, I like to think about why power and do power. So why power is what fuels your willpower.
Right.
So for instance, Stacey, if you were on the Empire State Building and I cloned it and made another Empire State Building that was 10 feet away and I put a ladder across it or a platform and said, all right, Stacey, if you walk across that platform, I'll give you a dollar. Would you do it?
For a dollar? Probably not.
Yeah, most people would not, almost certain death, right, would not attempt that for a dollar. Now, if it was me and you said, all right, Larry, I have your kids and I'm going to steal them if you do not walk across here. Well, guess who's walking across here?
Right.
Why? Because the situation didn't change. The only thing that changed was my why for doing it, the why power. So if you want to get, James Clear talks about this in his book, Atomic Habits, but if you want to get fit and your goal is, I want to lose 30 pounds, that is the wrong way to think about it. It's outcome based.
Right.
Instead, you want to think of the identity that you want to assume. So when we think about identity, don't think about present tense, think about future tense.
Right.
So if you went out and bought a uniform and your white belt, you are a martial artist. You're not an aspiring martial artist. You're not a future. You are a martial artist. So how does a martial artist act? So here we want to create this identity that helps pull us forward, which we can root into our why power, which can refuel and replenish our willpower. Now, willpower is great, but we need to transmute that willpower into do power. And how do we do that? There's only one way, action.
Mm-hmm.
We can sit here, we can talk about it all day. I have this will, I have this desire, but none of that matters unless I put it into action.
Right.
And here's something that most people don't know, that if you don't take action, you're actually draining your willpower when you're ruminating or you're trying to think of the perfect situation.
Right.
So you think, oh, you come up with this cool plan, right? You have all the steps. Now, two things happen. One, your willpower is depleted, so you're not going to do anything that day. Secondly, your brain then gets tricked to believe you actually made progress because you spent a lot of time thinking about it. So basically nothing happened, but you feel like you got something done.
Right.
Does that remind you of anything? How about the head of the Hydra, which we call what? The phantom, self-delusion.
Right.
That we can sit here, we can make this plan, the perfect plan, but we didn't execute anything. That's the power of do power. So
right.
When you have a why power, something that is so powerful, a reason for what you're doing, if you look at all the individuals who have been successful in life, they've had a powerful why power. That will fuel your willpower. And from that willpower, you have to turn it into action, which is do power.
Right. I like that a lot. Now, this is something that I think people will really connect with. You say that every destructive pattern contains a corruptive superpower. Can you explain that? Like, for example, how is perfectionism connected to excellence?
So perfectionism is basically this perversion of what I like to call optimalism. So we think we have to be perfect. We can't make mistakes, not realizing that mistakes are the way that we actually succeed to achieve.
Right.
I tell people, if you're not making mistakes, then you're not aiming high enough at life. If you're just going through your day and everything is going great, you're playing it small. you're falling into what I call the trap of complacency.
Right.
So when you have something new that comes into your life, like this, having my fifth child, my fourth daughter, it was difficult. But once you start getting the hang of it, oh, the sleep deprivation and all that, once you start getting into a rhythm, it no longer challenges you the same way.
Right.
So you have become stronger, but also that situation is no longer challenging.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is we sit here because it's comfortable, like we're on top of the world rather than creating that next aspect. So
right.
Each of the heads of the Hydra has a hidden superpower. So perfectionism is optimalism. Like we want to choose excellence. We want to have that arete in our life, but we don't want to get to that point of perfection because perfection will stop us from acting. Remember, action's the only way we can get there.
Yeah.
And if we think of it like an arrow versus a missile.
Mm-hmm.
An arrow, once you let go, you have no control over it.
Right.
But a missile, once you shoot it and your target moves, you can have it guiding. You can control where it goes.
Right.
So we don't want to shoot arrows. We want to shoot missiles because we have control over where we're going. But we look at, you know, that kind of that self-esteem. Through that process, we have to learn more about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an odyssey. It's an opportunity to learn about who I am, what I'm called to do, and the core four values of our lives. I believe that each one of us has four different values that are kind of like the seeds are planted when we're born, and then our life is the perfect laboratory for us to develop those seeds.
Right.
For instance, my best friend is introverted. You put him in front of on a stage of 1,000 people, he will freak out and shut down.
Mm-hmm.
But you put him in the back behind the scenes with spreadsheets and data, he comes alive.
Yeah.
Now, I'm the exact opposite. You give me spreadsheets, I will beat my head and hope that it's over. But you put me on stage in front of 1,000 people and I will come alive. I will feed off the crowd and we were going to have a great conversation.
Right.
And this was innate in me. My mom could see it when I was younger. It was innate in me in my life because I chose certain things, allowed these values to foster and to get and to grow and to develop. And this is what I call as your soul print. Just like your fingerprint, each one of us has our soul print. This is the indelible mark that we leave on people that we interact with.
Right.
So when I interact with Stacy, I would say, oh, Stacy is this, this, and this.
Mm-hmm.
And you would say, oh, Larry is this, this, and this. And that is kind of the mark that we leave.
Yeah.
So it's the importance that we go back through our life, through our, I use a exercise here. We go back through our memories and we find out those moments that are our triumph or our highs in life and those that are our lows. Because the triumph are typically times where what we value was valued and celebrated.
Yes.
And the low points is the times when what we valued was dismissed or invalidated or disregarded or trampled
right.
on or dishonored. And so when we look at this, once again, we're like the cell differentiation. Each one of us is a different cell and we're called to grow into something else. And so by having those identity of our core values, then we have to live in life in a way that is in alignment with those core four values.
Right.
Because just like a tourniquet, if we don't honor our values, a part of us dies.
Mm-hmm. So true. Now, how is people-pleasing connected to empathy?
So people-pleasing is going to be this idea where we kind of lack empathy. So there's this idea of a near enemy. So people believe that sympathy and empathy are almost the same thing, and they're very different because empathy fosters connection.
Yeah.
Sympathy fosters distance.
Yes.
So sympathy is an intellectual practice, and empathy is an emotional vulnerability practice. So people pleasing gets in the way of empathy. But if you go through and you figure out the mechanisms of people pleasing and the reasons that you're doing things, then through that, you can actually develop the skill, because it is a skill, the skill of empathy. So for instance, people pleasing says that I have to become what you want me to be to have value and worth.
Mm-hmm.
Empathy stops making it because it's obviously about me. In this weird sense, it's about me. Empathy is more about who you are. I want to know your story, even when it's different from mine. I want to have that. And I have this concept, Stacy, because of course I do. I know I have concepts. I call it a soul port. It's like a passport for those that you interact with in this crazy journey called life.
Right.
So of all the people who have been a positive influence in your life and those who have been a negative influence in your life, they have stamped your soul point.
Yeah.
Either with a soul print, the good values, their alignment, or a shadow print, which is when we live in misalignment.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal here isn't who stamped your book and what print they use, but it's like, who are you stamping and what are you stamping them with? Are you giving them the very best? Are you influencing them? Are you encouraging them? Are you helping them to create that masterpiece that's called within them? Or are you an obstacle or a hurdle that's slowing them down?
Right.
So when we look at people pleasing, it's such a cancer within our society because people are so afraid to be seen. They're so afraid. They feel like if people could see the real them, they would be unworthy of love.
Right.
And that's going to be what the Hydra whispering, right? It's the whisper and the sentence. You're not worthy of love. So you have to trick people into loving you.
Right.
And so we really have to work through that and find that empathy within ourselves, that self-empathy, that self-compassion, before we can then go on that journey with others and extend it to them.
Right. I like that. Now, how is self-doubt connected to discernment?
Self-doubt. So here's an aspect. So Adam Grant talks about this in his book, Think Again. Kind of this spectrum of, you know, imposter syndrome. So having this idea that a little bit of imposter syndrome is good. On the other end of the spectrum is the Dunning-Kruger effect. The Dunning-Kruger effect basically says, you know a little bit about something and now you think you're an expert.
Yeah.
So this is all those armchair quarterbacks who, you know, this coach who's getting paid millions of dollars, this guy who ran track in high school can tell you exactly what you should do for this multi-billion dollar franchise.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Dunning-Kruger effect. It's just, you know enough to be dangerous. Now, the opposite is what is called the imposter syndrome. So that's when your competence is higher than your confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So you're able to do it, but the confidence that is not right there. It's kind of this healthy skepticism. On the other side is your competence is very low and your confidence is very high. Like, I can do this. They did a study and they asked, I think it was like 100 men, how well they thought that they drove. And all of them said above average, all of them, which, you know, due to the law of averages, that doesn't make sense. Half of them would have to be worse. But this is showing what that Dunning-Kruger effect. So when we're looking at self-doubt, self-doubt is good because we don't want to become too hot, too airy and think we know it all.
Yeah.
We want to have that humility to learn. The humility to, they say the issue with a master is you can never teach him anything. And that sometimes the novice will beat the master because the novice, what, still has that malleable brain. They're still learning. They're still open to interpretation. That's why new counselors, so counselors that are being supervised, have better therapeutic outcomes than seasoned counselors because the new counselor is still learning. They're still growing. They don't think they know it all. They allow the client to tell them their story and they validate them. So self-doubt is a good kind of anchor point because it allows you to think of it, the balloon. Don't fly away. It helps keep you anchored to the ground.
Right. That's great. Now, let's make this practical. If someone is listening right now and they feel exhausted, they feel stuck, or they're like not living it at full capacity, what is the first step that they should do?
The first step is going to be implementing ultradian rhythm breaks. So now an ultradian rhythm is, most of us know a circadian rhythm. That's a 24-hour cycle.
Yeah.
Now, an ultradian rhythm is anything that is less than 24 hours. So that's going to be something, our sleep cycles, our different sleeps are about an hour and a half to 2 hours. Now, what's interesting about that is our productivity cycles are an hour and a half to 2 hours as well.
Right.
So if you start work at 8 o'clock, you'll start noticing around 9:30, 10 o'clock, you start feeling that dip.
Yeah.
The hour and a half to 2 hours, and this is fine if you do it every hour and a half to be preemptive, take a break. So that means get up, go get some water, go for a walk, do these things, and set these breaks within your day. Because what most people do, they'll charge through their entire day.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the day, they try to recoup and to undo all that stress that they built up through the day. And if you don't do it at that time, when you go to sleep, that's what's going to happen. Instead of consolidating new memories and resting, your brain is going to be trying to get rid of all of the stress.
Yes.
If your brain doesn't get rid of all the stress and doesn't de-stress you, when you wake up in the morning, you now start off in a day stressed. And then you will take on the stress of the day as well. And so you keep uploading that stress. So it's taking those smaller breaks throughout the day. Anytime you know something that's going to be draining mentally and or emotionally, I like to call it the cushion of stress. So what you want to do is you want to do something preemptively that you enjoy. So maybe it's going to your favorite burger place, or maybe it's reading your favorite book, or listening to your favorite song, or watching your favorite movie, something that's going to, you know, help get you into that state. And then after the stressful event, then you're going to do something there to take care of it, post care as well. So pre and post care. So just by doing those simple things of being aware of your body and your body, a lot of times you'll feel that bathroom break needing at about an hour and a half to 2 hours, because that's your brain saying, hey, I'm tired of doing this. Let's go. Because if you don't do that, what happens is your productivity cycles the peaks get lower and lower and lower and lower. And then we have the typical, we work 8 hours a day, but the last hour is just waiting for the hour to get up, right? So it's finding that time so that we can be in our natural flow state of productivity rather than trying to force it.
I love that. Now, how do they begin closing those open loops.
Yeah, closing open loops is basically you can write down all the things that are bugging you or that is on your mind. That's the first step. Once you write it down, your brain doesn't have to remember them.
Mm-hmm.
Then if you give each kind of process a due date or a time that you're going to work through it, then your brain can close that loop because it's no longer open. It has an endpoint. Oh, great. We're going to do that at this time. So then your brain, it's a tab within your head. You're like, click, click. You're closing them and they're not open. So they're not utilizing that valuable cognitive energy, but also emotional energy.
Right.
So it's writing them down. That's the first step. Write them down and then talk about, okay, here's this thing. When am I going to handle this? Okay, I'm going to handle it here. I'm going to do this here. When you start doing that, you're telling your brain, hey, I have a plan for all these things. It's going to be okay. And your brain's like, all right, I'll trust you. And so then you'll find out that emotional pull, it gets less and less. And these are some things that you have to practice. It's not just going to be this one time you do it and
yeah,
you'll feel a little bit okay and keep doing that because neurons that fire together, wire together. That's Hebb's law. So if you do this more times than not, anytime you begin writing down what once has been stressing you, you will eventually automatically feel what? Relaxation, because you have taught your brain that this is how it works.
Exactly. Now, how do they start reclaiming energy that is tired to old pain, old identities, and old patterns?
Yeah, once again, you can go ahead and write this down again, just so when you write it down, you take the abstract and you make it concrete. And you can kind of talk about, you know, what was the context of the situation around the relationship or the job or whatever it was. And then you want to kind of have like this mourning period. You want to talk about, well, what did I learn about myself from this? Even though it ended, even though it's hurtful, it's painful, what did I learn about myself? How can I grow from this experience? Or what information, what knowledge can I take from this into my current life?
Right.
So what's happening here, you're pulling these anchors out of your body and using them to go forward and to grow and to become this different version of you. Now, that's something that can't happen if, you know, we don't take the time to acknowledge them. And Robin Sharma has a process in his book. Let's see, which one is this? The Everyday Hero Manifesto. It's called AFRA, which is awareness of why you feel what you feel. The feeling. So allow yourself to feel what you're feeling.
Right.
Release that feeling. Right. I like to imagine myself, you know, I'm breathing in relaxation and I'm breathing out that stress. I'm breathing out that pain. I'm breathing out whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then finally ascending. So it's like, how am I going to be a better version of myself because of this?
Right.
No matter I was wounded, right? They say that where the arrow pierces the heart is where the light shines through. So how, despite this pain, how I'm going to show up more effectively for my job and more effectively for people, but more efficiently with my job, with my task, with whatever is in my domain.
Right. I love that. Now, you've also lived a very intense and disciplined life, like martial arts from childhood and endurance challenges, a PhD, clinical work, and now raising 5 young kids. How did your own life shape the work that you do today?
I like to say I was born in controversy. So my mom is a white woman and my father is a black man. And I was conceived out of wedlock in a small East Texas town in the early 90s. So talk about double taboo. So I think it was just me coming into my own and figure out what's my place going to be in this world. Because as someone who is both black and white, it was always a sense of being a cultural orphan. So being black and white, you are too black to be in the white culture, right? You can be a part of it and understand it, but like it's not the same. But also, I never really knew my father or really got to know him or that side. So there's a term, I can code switch, right? But I don't know that, I don't have that emotional root deep within of my black culture.
Right.
And so I'd say that, you know, that's something I can't really pass on to my kids because I have a surface level, superficial exposure to it.
Yes.
And so through this, it's a whole process of all these things that happened to me. They define where I'm starting, but they're not going to define where I end up. So it's about making meaning. And then, okay, well, how is this going to add to my story? Right? I like to say everything adds to your testimony.
Yeah.
So whether it works out, awesome. If it doesn't work out, great. Now you have more people who are going to relate to you.
Yeah.
And so I just see it as a journey, as a challenge, and as a fun masterpiece. So not only the masterpiece that I'm hopefully creating through my book, through the work that I do, but my life. I want my life to be my final masterpiece.
Yes. I love that. Now, what did your resilience teach you about traditional self-help what people miss?
I think that, so here's the thing about resiliency. Resiliency is on the frame of the anti-fragile spectrum. So there's anti-fragility, there's fragility, resilience, and then anti-fragility. Mm-hmm. I didn't like that. So I replaced anti-fragility with endurigent. So you endure, it gets stronger through that process.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So I think so many people they look at resilience. Resilience is good, but you want to make it so that the challenges actually make you stronger.
Yeah.
That you see the challenge and you know that it's a reverse indicator. Mm-hmm. When there's fear involved, typically I know that whatever's on the other side is going to cause me to grow.
Right.
So I want to run towards the fear rather than away from it.
Yeah.
It also talks about how it's not going to be neat. It's going to be messy. And you have to know who you are and what kind of seed you are.
Right.
Now, everybody, like anybody can go out and you can have the support and you can get to the medical degree, but not everybody's called to be a doctor and not everybody's going to be a great doctor. So here, that's why it's important that we live in that alignment and we kind of reject the values that have been forced upon either from our family, for our culture, for our profession, whatever it is, and really dive down. That's why you see a lot of people who have that second career, that they'll work in corporate America, they'll sell their souls and they're like, okay, I'm tired of this. And then they'll go do something that really, where they can really thrive.
Yeah.
And it's because they were afraid at the time to make that choice, to walk away from that, which didn't align with them.
Right.
So that's why I use the core four values as kind of as a compass. Does this alignment with me? Is this going to take me where I need to go?
Yeah. Oh, I like that. Now, if there's one thing you want people to understand about becoming fully alive, what would it be?
It is a messy science project. It's not going to be, we think of success as this nice little straight line. No, you're going to have detours. I'd say success is a direction. It's not a destination.
Right.
We don't know where we're going to end up. And it's about what are we doing in this moment to get me closer to whatever that's going to be.
Exactly.
And I have to say it is a wild ride. And so many people, they want to plan out the entire trip before they start. Don't do that. You'll never start. Start and figure it out as you go. So be like Frodo in Lord of the Rings. You got to start, and when trouble comes up, you have solved that problem, and then you get to the next one and solve that problem.
Yeah.
You can't account for every single thing that you're going to face on this journey because no one has taken the journey that you were called to take.
Right.
Everyone's looks different, and everyone's going to have their own little pitfalls, but that's a part of the journey.
Right.
In every superhero movie, you have this moment where they're kicking butt, and then something happens. They either lose their powers, or the villain becomes stronger, or their loved one dies, whatever it is, and they get set back. And the setback is preparation for what? That comeback. So we have to think about that in this aspect. When we're building a muscle, when we're in the gym, we have to break down the muscle before we grow it back. And that's the same thing in our lives. Our life is going to break us down, but we have to build ourselves back stronger. And that's not a deficiency. That's not a bug in the code. That is how it's supposed to be.
Right. I like that. Now, you've been working on a book for some time now, and it should be ready to launch probably at the end of the year. Can you tell us a little about the book?
Yes, the book is called The Code of the Unreasonable Life, because we know that this world turns because of unreasonable people. So this is going to look at, we have a fictional family that we talk about in there, Grayson, and he's kind of living out of alignment with his life.
Yeah.
And so I go and I talk about my own life, my struggles with the death race, the loss of my brother, just my own experiences of life, and then all of my different frameworks. And it helps you to build this unreasonable life one step at a time. There
right.
are seven kind of laws of the unreasonable life. I'm not going to give them away here. You just have to check it on the book. But that you can look at it, that spells out the entire code of the unreasonable life.
Right. I love that. I love that. And also, can you tell us a little about the services that you provide?
Yes. Right now, I am doing one-on-one coaching, but I also do workshops and larger events for companies as well. But I have three different tiers for individuals who want to be fully alive. Now, I need to let you know, fully alive is not for everyone. If I have to drag you to the finish line, that's not what I'm here for. I want people who are motivated. They're going to do the work. They're going to sit in the vulnerability. They're going to sit with the suck. They're going to wrestle with the thing, but they're going to do the work, and they're going to be the ones who see the outcome. They're going to see that growth. They're going to see that moment. And you can get a hold of me in that way. You can go to choosefullyalive.com. Once again, you have to choose to be fully alive, right? So choosefullyalive.com. Or you can email me at Freeney, Freeney, L as in Larry, G as in greatest, @gmail.com. And we can have a free 15-minute consultation. But also, if you email me, reach out to me, I will send you my free soul print distillation process. So it's a 30-minute video that walks you through the entire process of you learning your soul print, your core four values that are guiding you, whether you know it or not, and that you need to live in alignment with if you are going to live fully alive.
I love that. I love that. You know, I want people out there to realize that sometimes exhaustion is not just physical. Sometimes it's emotional, sometimes it's mental, and sometimes it comes from carrying pieces of yourself in places you no longer belong. The good news is that you can begin reclaiming them. Larry, I just want to say thank you for being on the show today. You know, you really have a wonderful way of looking at things, and it's so helpful for somebody who really needs to move on with their life and really needs to get things in alignment. And, you know, you can turn your life around. You know, you just have to want it bad enough. And you just have to, you know, want to see things in a different light. And you show that it's possible. And, you know, you back it up by science, by your own experience in life, by, you know, other people's experiences in life. And I just want to say thank you.
You know, thank you, Stacey, so much for having me. You know, I just, like I said, that's my mission. So my helix, which is, I used to call the North Star, but my purpose in life is to ignite the dying or dormant flames within the hearts and souls of others so that they may be equipped, inspired, and encouraged to transmute that masterpiece that was woven into their very fabric of their being into value and connection in the world.
Thank you so much, Larry, for being on the show. So I appreciate you, and thank you so much for what you're doing.
Thank you so much, and I'll be back soon.
Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Jeff's rugby team will depart in 5 minutes from platform 15. Your ride comes with 6 toilets and a refreshments carriage that you'll empty within 5 minutes. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.